Good afternoon and welcome to Statewide Grand Rounds, sponsored by the New York State Office of Mental Health's Bureau of Psychiatric Services and Research Institute support. I'm Dr. Lloyd Setterer, Medical Director of the New York State Office of Mental Health, and I'll be your host for today's presentation, which we call First Episode Psychosis, What Makes a Difference? The New York State Office of Mental Health is accredited by the Medical Society of the State of New York to provide continuing medical education credit to physicians. We select our Grand Rounds topics and develop the content of each program with OMH psychiatrists and physicians in mind. We also welcome viewers from other mental health service systems and professions and hope that these programs will be of benefit to you as well. I want to remind you that the slides for today's program and many additional resources are available at the OMH Internal Continuing Medical Education website, also sponsored by the Bureau of Psychiatric Services. Please note, you must be a New York State OMH employee to access this secure site. However, you can also use this internal site to view archive videos of previous statewide satellite grand rounds, and we have quite a developed archive at this point. The web address is at the bottom of your screen. And if you're not an OMH employee, we want these grand rounds to be available to you, and you can view them on our archive statewide grand rounds videos on the OMH external website through the internet. And we usually post these about 4 weeks after this or any other live broadcast. And we encourage others to turn to our archived grand rounds. And that web address is at the bottom also of your screen. We're going to open our phone lines towards the end of the program, and we invite your questions via our toll-free number. Please give us a call. We'd like it when you call. You can also email your questions to us at any time during the program, and we'll use those to enhance the conversation throughout the show. Our email address is swgr@omh.ny.gov. We're also asking GoToMeeting participants who are increasing numbers view these through GoToMeeting not to use this SWGR address, not the GoToMeeting mailbox, because we do not monitor that, but we do monitor the SWGR site. So let's turn to the program. Our guests today are Dr. Lisa Dixon. Welcome back, Lisa.
Thank you very much.
Director of the Center for Practice Innovations at the New York State Psychiatric Institute and professor at Columbia University's Medical Center. And we also welcome back John Kane. John, delighted to have you here. Real honor for us. Chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at Hofstra North Shore LIJ School of Medicine and the Zucker Hillside Hospital. Welcome to both of you, and thanks again for joining us. In the interest of full disclosure, we want you to be aware that Dr. John Kane has indicated that he has the following financial affiliations: consultant and or speakers bureau member of Alkermes, Bristol-Myers Squibb, Eli Lilly, Genentech, H. Lundbeck, Intracellular Therapeutics, Janssen Pharmaceuticals, Johnson & Johnson, Otsuka, Reviva, and Roche. He's also a shareholder in MedAvante Incorporated. All the other faculty and planners associated with the CMA activity have indicated that they have no financial arrangements or affiliations, and myself included, with any commercial entities whose products, research, or services may be discussed in these materials. Any discussion of investigational or unlabeled uses of a product will be identified. So now let's get to why we're here, the educational aspects of this program. Schizophrenia remains one of the most disabling and costly disorders, costly both in terms of human costs and financial costs in this country. It's the fifth leading cause of disability in the United States. We spend enormous amounts of money on this, both for the direct and indirect costs associated with schizophrenia spectrum illness, And those are the financial costs, which don't give us any sense of really the human, family, and social costs. We do know that chronic psychotic illness, particularly if untreated and not treated well, is associated with, can be devastating for affected families, individuals, and their communities. But we do believe, and that's why we're doing this program today, that early intervention and treatment of individuals experiencing psychosis offers considerable hope for those people impacted. And it's the right blend of engagement, retention, psychosocial and pharmacological supports that can reduce disability and may even alter the natural course of the history for some individuals. And towards our understanding that better and being able to apply it, we have two of the nation's leading experts with us today to help us sort out what interventions can really make a difference. In the first portion of the program, we'll examine some of the clinical challenges of working with individuals experiencing first episode psychosis, as well as identify some of the crucial elements of services for these people that are associated with more optimal outcomes, better treatment results. The final portion of the program will focus on pharmacological treatment for these patients, including some discussion of a recent Dutch study which has intrigued many of us in the psychiatric community as well as in the lay community. At the conclusion of the program, participants should be able to first identify the most important clinical challenges in providing treatment to individuals experiencing a first episode of psychosis. Second, outline the critical service elements needed to obtain optimal outcomes for these individuals experiencing early psychosis. And third, understand and summarize the elements of a psychopharmacological management, including how to use shared decision-making and choice of medication in the care of individuals experiencing first episode of psychosis. So now let's turn to our experts and learn from them. First, we're going to ask Dr. Kane to provide a foundation, some introduction to this topic, and then we'll turn to Lisa and then back to John for some of the details. Lisa? John?
Thanks very much, and it's a tremendous pleasure to be here. As we talk about the unique challenges and opportunities associated with the treatment of the very first episode, it's important to remind ourselves of the clinical characteristics of patients with first episode psychosis. They're typically adolescents or young adults, so it's a very important stage in their development, whether it be socially, vocationally, or academically. The families are often actively engaged. It's a very difficult time for them as well. We need to work very closely with them. On average, individuals who are experiencing their first treatment have lived with untreated psychotic symptoms for at least a year or more. And there are a number of unfortunate things that are associated with a longer duration of untreated psychosis, and we'll come back to that later. The goals we have to keep in mind are returning the individual or sustaining mainstream functioning. And we need to understand that the identified goals that the patient has are particularly important. It's not what we think is important. It's what they view as their own goals. We also recognize that in comparison to their peers, even at that stage of illness, they likely have some degree of cognitive impairment. They have poorer psychosocial functioning. And in addition, they're more likely to smoke and or abuse substances. So we have those challenges to keep in mind as well. Engagement in treatment can be difficult. We have to make sure that the treatment is accepted, understood, and desired, that it's meeting the individual's needs. Again, the importance of establishing goals is absolutely critical. The understanding that the individual has of the illness may be limited or emerging, but even lack of insight shouldn't prevent us from working with an individual to try to achieve some of their fundamental goals. The experience of the psychosis itself can be traumatizing, as can be...
John, when you say traumatizing, what are you referring to?
Sure. Well, there's the internal experience, which can be traumatizing. So imagine what it's like to be hearing voices and you don't understand what's happening, and that's very disturbing to you. I mean, that's traumatic. In addition, you may have been confronted with a police intervention, bringing you to a hospital against your will. Yeah. So there are a whole series of things
From inside and outside, these are sources of trauma that we need to keep in mind patients are experiencing.
Yeah, absolutely. And then non-adherence to medication and treatment dropout are all too common. I mean, no one wants to take medication on a long-term basis, and I think we have to be very thoughtful about how we approach that issue. And engagement in treatment is absolutely critical, because the initial tendency, particularly if someone responds well during their first treatment, is going to be, say, I don't need any more treatment, I'm fine. I'd rather forget about what happened. I mentioned earlier that the average duration of untreated psychosis in the U.S. is about a year, and the implications of that include a greater decrease in functioning, loss of educational opportunities, impaired psychosocial and vocational development, of course, personal suffering and family burden. And then once people do receive treatment, there's the possibility that the response to treatment may be poorer depending upon the duration of untreated psychosis. Then we have the costs associated with that, and unfortunately, the potential for self-harm or injury to others increases as the duration of untreated psychosis increases. Now, we also know that after the first episode, there is a risk of a relapse or recurrence. These are data from Delbert Robinson at Zucker Hillside Hospital, showing in a cohort of 104 first episode patients that after 5 years, 82% had at least one psychotic relapse, and in some cases more than one relapse. So it suggests that relapse is a risk. It also underscores the fact that there's a subgroup of patients who did not relapse within that time frame, and we need to keep that in mind as well.
And this slide, for those who may not be able to see it so well, is in the archive materials that we have. And this has been a very big matter of contention as people debate, are these medicines useful? Are they toxic? But there is a very high risk, is what you're saying here, to not prescribing medications.
Absolutely. But I do want to emphasize, although the patients participating in this study had access to very good social services and individual and group therapy, they didn't have access to the full array of multimodal treatments that Lisa and I are going to be talking about. And there certainly is the possibility and the hope that if we can bring together state-of-the-art psychosocial interventions with state-of-the-art psychopharmacology, that we can bring about a significant reduction in relapse rates.
Yes.
But in this cohort of patients, when Dr. Robinson looked at predictors of relapse, what he found as the single most powerful predictor was stopping medication. So those patients who stopped medication were 5 times more likely to relapse than those patients who continued on medication. So it can be a very powerful effect. He also looked at those factors that were associated with non-adherence or stopping medication. And it turned out that early adolescent premorbid adjustment, worse premorbid cognitive function, the occurrence of Parkinsonian side effects early in treatment, and worse executive function were associated with a greater likelihood of stopping medication. And I particularly want to emphasize the Parkinsonian side effects, because it reminds us that those individuals who are experiencing treatment for the very first time are particularly sensitive to drug side effects, and it may actually color their attitude towards medication even way down the road.
And this includes akathisia, the restless.
Yes, absolutely. Akathisia and other Parkinsonian side effects, rigidity, slowness of movement, lack of spontaneity, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Good. Okay, well, thank you for laying down such a clear and important foundation for us. We're going to turn now to Lisa. Lisa, teach us a lot more about the services that can make a difference.
I'm really glad to be here, and I'm appreciative of the invitation. Before I review the critical elements that I think John kind of referred to in his discussion of the earlier studies that really had a much more narrow psychosocial support that was complementing the medication treatment in these early studies, I want to just mention two important programs that really contribute to the knowledge that we've obtained about this topic. And one is RAISE. RAISE stands for Recovery After Initial Schizophrenia Episode, and it's a research program funded by the National Institute of Mental Health. And there are two RAISE projects, one called RAISE Connection, which was conducted here in New York State and in Maryland. And the RAISE Connection program has kind of morphed into OnTrack New York, which is our local statewide initiative to try to bring these services to citizens of the state of New York. The second RAISE project, very large RAISE project, national RAISE project led by Dr. Kane, the RAISE Early Treatment Program, which you'll hear more about later, also has been extremely important and will continue to be extremely important in informing this field. And you'll hear a little bit more about that later. So the NIMH, which convened which funded these RAISE projects, convened a meeting in which we discussed, leaders in first episode psychosis in the U.S. discussed, well, what's the evidence and what do we think are the critical elements of this coordinated team-based care? And that's what I'll be reviewing on these next few slides. So the first component is individual and group therapy. Much of this is familiar to many of you who have been practicing. These kinds of therapies aim to restore wellness, to enhance coping, and John talked about the trauma of having this illness and these symptoms occur. And so we need to teach coping skills, and we really want to focus on resilience, which is really tapping into people's strengths in navigating these symptoms and challenges. And importantly, we want to teach people skills to prevent relapse. We want to teach them to identify the early signs and to take steps both in terms of their own, what Pat Deegan would call personal medicine, which is the things that one can do, and their psychiatric medicine, which are the medicines that they take. And we want always to be thinking of both of those strategies. These therapies are based largely on cognitive behavioral principles. The competencies that are needed on the part of clinicians to offer these are knowledge of how to do shared decision-making, motivational interviewing, and psychoeducation, among others. And also, these individual group therapies
I may, for a moment, because each of these are so important, and they're... I wonder if you might just say a word about each of these, or maybe your subsequent slides will elaborate. Mm-hmm. But each of these elements, shared decision-making, motivational interviewing, mm-hmm. psychoeducation, have become so much a part of the way we're trying to advance our and revolutionize, if you will, the way that we approach mm-hmm. patient care mm-hmm. and the way that we enable people to take control right. of their own lives.
Well, this is really all about person-centered care. It's about making the decisions with the individual who's experiencing the illness, making the decisions with them about what they want and what they need. And if that person, if the individual that we're working with decides that they want medicine or that they want to participate in cognitive behavioral treatment or they want supported education, and if they understand what they're going to get out of it, then they're going to be a lot more likely to participate meaningfully and complete it and engage in it.
Right.
And so shared decision-making really is a set of strategies to make that happen. And motivational interviewing is really a part of that as well. It's mm-hmm. really helping people to weigh the pluses and minuses because, of course, these decisions are not straightforward. There's always a cost and there's always a benefit. And so how, you know, motivational interviewing helps people to identify those and make the kinds of decisions that they think are going to be best for themselves.
In some ways, these have turbocharged psychoeducation, because psychoeducation was about giving people information. But this is very different. This is about harnessing their own thinking, their own will, their own critical capacity to take charge of their own lives.
Well, and I think of psychoeducation as a part of the process, because in order to make good decisions, you have to know and be informed about the you know, what the benefits might be. So psychoeducation is really embedded in the processes of shared decision making and motivational interviewing. The final piece that I wanted to mention in terms of individual and group therapy is again this focusing on coping with the trauma of psychosis, suicidality. People who are early in the course of schizophrenia are at high risk for suicide. And, you know, we have, again, this positive focus on skill building. And I think, as John mentioned, the high rates of smoking, we have to really focus on health and trying to stop that tendency of people who receive antipsychotic medications to gain weight and really have problems with their health. Second piece of this comprehensive package is integrated addictions treatment. Substance use disorders or substance use is very common among people, young people, and then, you know, even more common among young people experiencing the first episode of psychosis. This is a very, very a harm reduction approach. We focus on education and helping people to see how stopping using will help them to attain their personal goals.
Harm reduction is different from abstinence.
Exactly.
How so?
We don't start with the requirement, oh, you must stop using. We start with helping the person to understand how their goals may or may not be, how their ability to obtain their goals may be hindered by their using. And we want, it's all about goals. It's all about helping people to make that connection. And it's all about helping our young people to realize they can have goals. That this is not, this illness is not about not having goals. This illness is about working within one's strengths and sort of trying to buttress supports for one's the challenges that, that the illness causes. And so we, you know, harm reduction is about trying to minimize the negative impact of substance use. And that's how
we talk
about it.
Well put. Thank you.
Teaching skills for managing substance use, developing relapse prevention plans. And I just wanted to show this slide that comes from a study of an early psychosis program, of individuals in an early psychosis program in Calgary. And what you see here are the rates of use of alcohol and cannabis and other drugs. The blue bars are relatively higher, 30-40% at baseline, and they follow people over time. And what you see is the rates of both alcohol and cannabis use go down dramatically and maybe cut in half by 1 year. And that's without really, really high-powered substance use treatment. It's just with sort of the kind of informed, goal-centered substance use treatment. And I think that what has been seen now in a number of studies throughout the world is that if we just supply individuals with reasonably good, informed substance use treatment that attends to substance use, the rates will go down. And of course, there are individuals who persist, and the unfortunate part of that is that persistent substance use is associated with increased positive and psychotic symptoms. So it is a problem, but most people, for most people with first episode psychosis, the use of substances will decline.
And decline without a full substance abuse program around some of the motivational enhancements, some of the conversations that our clinicians can have with their patients. This is not about their necessarily going to an AA or an NA meeting.
Exactly. I mean, and they might do that. But I think this doesn't necessarily require specialized addiction programming, you know, outside of the mainstream of, right. of what we do. I mean, right. People have to learn it, and we have to have competencies in it. But I think that there's sometimes a tendency to think, oh, that there's such high rates of substance use, and they don't, it's, mm-hmm. you know, impossible to influence, and that's just not true.
Right. And, okay. And this has been a core premise about having integrated health, mental health and exactly. substance abuse treatment in our mental health centers, and some of the work that mm-hmm. Your center has done right. in terms of providing right. the technical right. assistance,
exactly.
educational,
yeah.
so that people can learn motivational right. interviewing and other kinds of skills that help their patients without having to ever leave the clinic
exactly.
to get care.
Yeah. So the Center for Practice Innovations has available to all clinicians practicing in mental health in the state training in how
yes.
to do use these kinds of methods. The next very, very important area of focus for first episode services is family education and support. As John has already mentioned, the onset of psychosis is traumatic not only for the individual experiencing it, but for the family. And, of course, you have young people who are still very connected to their families but who are also in the process of separating from their families. This is their normal developmental trajectory. And so the challenge of both including families that can be very, very helpful, but also respecting the normal developmental process of helping these young people separate and develop their own independent lives. And so that's where the skill comes in doing this well. And we really should have almost 100% participation of families
yeah.
In these services. And of course, there's lots of different methodologies we can do. We can work with groups. We can work with individual families. And I think that this has to be done all with, again, some attention to respecting the privacy of the consumer. And it doesn't ever have to be all or nothing.
And how much does NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, play a role in terms of how your programming mm-hmm, uses mm-hmm. Resources outside of mm-hmm. the
well,
conventional mental health system?
The National Alliance on Mental Illness has a fantastic program called Family to Family Education, and I can think of several of the parents that we've worked with in On Track New York and in my own practice who've really benefited from participating in Family to Family. I think that what the clinicians need to do is really to work individually with each family member and sort of try to help them figure out what they need and what they're ready for, because mm-hmm. it really is a process for the family member in the same way that it's a process
yeah.
for the consumer of
yeah.
of learning about this and learning how to manage it. The next component of treatment is case management. Many of the individuals who experience first episode have many, many, many social and functional needs, and just like people in, you know, in general, the people who experience first episode, you know, just come from the general population. They may need help managing money, securing transportation. As John alluded to, having perhaps an experience with the police, there's people with first episode are at great risk of being arrested or interacting with the criminal justice system. There's a need for stable housing. And so the treatment needs to really pay attention to this, and there needs to be some capacity to go into the community with people. The next, and in some ways, you know, I could have led with supported employment and education.
Mm-hmm.
This is really, really the piece that I think we cannot be without, in addition to of course, meds. We have the model that we use in supported employment education is individual placement and support, and that's an integrated model. So in the same way that we have the addictions mm-hmm. at the table with the whole team function, we have employment and education. The supported employment and education council works with the family and supports and focuses both on work and school, because of course we've got young people who are in school, some mm-hmm. in high school, some in college, some in vocational programs. There's a focus on competitive employment and education that's really directed toward really developing a career. And when we ask people what they want, Why might they want to come into our program? They want to stay in school, they want to have their friends in school, or they want to be working. And this is the single most important engagement tool that we have.
So in terms of being able to provide people who come for care what they want, leading with this is apt to result in their being interested more than anything else?
Right, right. And then staying engaged, we've learned from the qualitative study that we've done of our RAISE project, is they want to see results.
Yeah.
And the supported employment and education is what helps them to get the results.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's saying to our clients, we believe that you can stay on your life trajectory, and we're going to help you do it.
That's where the hope lives.
Yeah, exactly. This is this next slide just shows you some of the results of the studies that have included supported employment and education, or IPS, in first episode programs. And what I just want to call your attention to are the high rates of participation in work and school. 70 or 80, even 90% in some newer studies. And that's really remarkable. These were people who entered these programs extremely symptomatic and whose lives could very easily have been derailed. And with individual placement and support and supported employment, you're seeing the majority, you know, if not close to 100%, being able to stay on course. And this is just a final graph from our local RAISE Connection program, which showed that over the course of 2 years, on average, we were able to assist people having school and work participation up to 80 or 90%.
Let's take a few minutes before we get to some of the questions. If we could go back one slide, because that bar chart seems to show some considerable variation.
Mm-hmm.
So some are succeeding with this and some are not succeeding so well. Is that?
Well, what you see here, some of the studies don't have control. So where there's two bars, the lower bar is the control condition without individual placement and support, but with everything else. And so what you see here is at least, I want you to focus on the green bars, because that's the most recent study conducted in the United States at UCLA with under the direction of Keith Nectarline, who is the principal investigator.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I think that's a remarkable increment of doubling the rates of school and work in that study. And they provided, these individuals were provided with very, very good care in both conditions. And so really, by having a dedicated person whose job it is to do job development, to be connected to the schools with whatever people need and in whatever ways they want to pursue work and school,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it's really out of the ballpark as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. That's very encouraging. John's going to, when he presents more material, he's going to talk about his national work. But tell us a little bit more about the work in New York State, the four projects that have begun around first episode psychosis, the what you described, the morphing of the RAISE project into what we're doing here in New York.
Okay. Well, we're very lucky in this state to have visionary leadership at the Office of Mental Health, and no one ask me to say that, really recognizing initially with the leadership of Mike Hogan and you, Lloyd, that how important it is to jump on this important development in mental health services. And so as the RAISE project came to an end, the state made a commitment to build up these first episode services, and we're starting with four sites in downstate. In one is actually at Long Island Jewish Hillside. The second is at New York State Psychiatric Institute.
Which would seem a bit, paradoxical, but John's sites are outside of New York State.
Exactly.
So could go to him and say, how about...
Let's do it here.
Right.
Right. And the, so the second site's New York State Psychiatric Institute, the third site is Kings County in Brooklyn, and the fourth site is Mental Health Association of Westchester. But it is our intent that to make these kinds of services available and to be able to train the workforce throughout the state to provide these services. And of course, as you know, we're working on issues around the financing, because that's really one of the greatest impediments.
Are these programs taking patients now?
Absolutely. All four of them are. And I do want to say that we modified the initial RAISE connection model, really getting input from the experts on the RAISE ETP team, so that we could really try to pull the best of both programs into this next version, this next iteration of services for people experiencing first episode psychosis. And I think I do want to do a shout out as well to the Parachute Project in New York City. This is a slightly different approach to trying to assist individuals who are experiencing early psychosis. The Parachutes Brooklyn program is focusing on first episode, and it's our hope that we will, that OnTrack New York will work together with Parachute to really try to figure out how to optimize the possibilities offered to individuals with first episode.
But it is our goal in New York State to have those four programs double, quadruple, and become available not just downstate but throughout the state on the basis of the work that you're doing and on the basis of learning better how to not just clinically but financially create sustainable programs.
Exactly.
Because many of these programs in the past were all dependent on fee-for-service, on procedure-based, if you did a clinic visit or if you did a medication visit, you got paid. But these programs, there's a lot of indirect care, and I mean that in that it's non-billable care.
Right.
It's just as important, just like with child services, so much surrounds that actual visit to of a child. And the same thing is true here, outreach, engagement. These are services we have to learn better how to create financing models so as to sustain.
Right, and I think that... you know, John talked earlier, we talked about the importance of reducing the duration of untreated psychosis. And we will not achieve our all of what we can achieve if we wait for people to come to us. We need to engage the community so that when people recognize that their loved one or their student or their client is experiencing psychosis, they help that person get to care. Or if, you know, even better, the individual, him or herself, recognizes this and seeks care. And so we have to build all of that into the model. And, you know, you might ask, well, isn't this going to cost an arm and a leg? And, you know, is this unaffordable? And, you know, research is, of course, beginning to look at the cost effectiveness of these models. But if you think about, first of all, the short-term reductions in hospitalizations that at least some programs have demonstrate. And then if we can actually, you know, which saves cost and saves money. And then if we think about what we're really after, which is the long-term benefits in terms of reducing disability.
Yeah, good. Well, thank you. So I want to turn to... some questions for both of you, that questions that have come in through email, and want to encourage our viewers to be in touch with us by email at this point, later by phone, but fax or email your questions to us. Email us swgr@omh.ny.gov, and our fax number, if you're still if you're near a fax machine, 1-518-426-4098. And here's a question back to duration of untreated psychosis that comes from Hutchings Psychiatric Center, from Dr. Sitha Ramanathan. And doctor asks, considering the goal of early intervention, that the goal is to reduce the duration of untreated psychosis, how would you describe treatment quote, unquote, and goes on to say, and I know we're going to do this later, but the findings of this Wunderwink study, this Dutch study, recovering study, where dose reduction and discontinuation. But there's a second question. But let's just ask you to respond to what is treatment? Because we have a conventional view of treatment, and then we have a treatment that is evolving.
Well, I can start. Mm-hmm. I think treatment obviously involves the things that we've been talking about, so it's not just one or the other. But I think that people who are experiencing the onset of psychosis do benefit very frequently from medication, which is not to say that that's the only treatment. Shortening the duration of untreated psychosis is an enormous public health challenge. There's no one strategy that's going to succeed in doing that. I think it requires a lot of public education, a lot of education even of our colleagues in general medicine. But once we do have the opportunity to engage someone in treatment, I think they need to be aware of the full range of options and the relative benefits and risks.
Right. And that gets to that person-first approach because there are, five or six components that you've already identified, and it's we're not the best ones to decide which ones.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I think that one of the comments I wanted to make about this notion of treatment is we've talked about treatment. I mean, these are not unfamiliar concepts to us. But when you ask a young person whether they want treatment, I think a lot of times they're going to say no, because their experience with treatment or their understanding of treatment is that it's not tethered to what they want. Mm-hmm. And so part of what this enterprise requires, helping individuals experiencing this in redefining their understanding of treatment. We want them to understand that treatment means helping them meet their goals.
Yeah. We don't want them to be compliant. We want them to pursue what they want, because people do what they want to do.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
And then it's hooking on to their direction and their motivation.
Right. And if they've had a negative experience with treatment in the past, you ask them if they want treatment, then they're really going to say no. Mm-hmm. So the enterprise really is about translating our understanding of treatment to their understanding of what will help them.
Right. Thank you. So the same doctor asks, and he takes it another step, which I think is one that has come up many times in conversation. So thinking about the future of early intervention, what are your thoughts regarding early intervention in prodromal stages, so-called prior to the first break, or in individuals identified as being in the high-risk or ultra-high-risk for psychosis categories? John, do you want to start?
Sure. Barbara Kornblatt at Zucker Hillside has a program that focuses specifically on that phase of illness. I think it's a tricky area because we are not yet really, really good at identifying the true prodrome. So the best we can do at this point is perhaps maybe 20 to 25% of people who we think are at risk for developing psychosis actually go on to develop psychosis. So I think we have to be very careful, how we work with these individuals, how we define what it is that they're experiencing. We don't want to put a premature label on it. But on the other hand, they are experiencing some disturbance and some decrement in functioning. So we do have to help them. I think they do often benefit from treatment.
What types of treatment?
It could be psychosocial treatment. It could be medication, because sometimes they're coming in with symptoms of depression or anxiety or what have you. But it has to be along the lines that Lisa mentioned a few minutes ago, that it has to be geared towards helping them achieve the goals that they have.
Right. Yeah, and I think a lot of the work in this area, we have to think about in general that there's undertreatment of youth globally. Mm-hmm. And so if we think about these individuals who we call ultra high risk, we're coming at it from this perspective of psychosis, but in fact, I think the literature suggests that individuals who are come to care and get that are put into that category, they have needs. They mm-hmm. have mental health needs. It just may not be that they're right. going to go on right. to develop a psychotic illness. So I think what we really need to do is think about what are the needs mm-hmm. of these individuals and try to help provide treatment that meets their needs. And my sense is that this is an emerging area of research. I don't think as much is known mm-hmm. about how to do a proper evaluation and how to then do treatment matching
right.
of this
so
group.
So we've got more to learn here. Here's mm-hmm. a question that comes from our colleague, Dr. Jay Carruthers, and reminds me of studies done a long time ago. Jay's too young for this, but this is about expressed emotion. That was a term probably that dates back to the 70s, I would guess, or something. And he asks, we've learned about the interplay between genetic vulnerability and environmental factors and risk of psychiatric illness. How would you put the expressed emotion, EE literature, in context today? Have the lessons learned from EE been integrated in today's optimal family psychoeducation for FEP? John, do you want to start? And then Lisa, I'm sure you've got some thoughts about this, too.
Sure. I think that there have been attempts to integrate it. I think, you know, obviously, the role of the family is complex.
Can you just define expressed emotion for those younger people watching?
Sure. Well, the notion was that amongst some family members, there was a response to the illness that could be very emotional. Mm-hmm. And the concern was that might, in fact, be an impediment to response and recovery. And I think it's complicated because, obviously, the families are often devastated. They don't know what to do, how to react. In the past, they were often blamed
yes.
for the illness itself. So I think we've come a long way. But we do have to understand that there are differences in the way people react to a challenging situation. They need help.
Mm-hmm.
They need help in terms of their own emotional response,
right.
How to interact, how to engage. But it just to me it's part of a literature that suggests that certain kinds of stresses can be detrimental.
Right.
And so we want to do whatever we can to reduce that kind of stress.
Expressed emotion may have also been a euphemism for being highly critical
yes.
or demanding
yes.
beyond people's
setting
capacity.
Unrealistic expectations,
yeah.
yes.
Yeah. Lisa, please, your thoughts about this.
This is a topic that is all, for me, it's very challenging because, of course, as the family movement or the family advocacy movement experienced this notion of expressed emotion as very, you know, further blaming families.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's something that the family world has reacted very negatively to. But actually, the original literature was that when individuals were discharged from the hospital, this was actually in UK, they evaluated a 5 or 10 minute interaction between a family member and an individual with schizophrenia, and they did these ratings, and
mm-hmm.
they rated criticism, over-involvement, emotionality, a whole bunch of
mm-hmm.
things. And they found that individuals who had family members where the interactions were rated as high in expressed emotion had greater rates of relapse or returning to the
yes.
hospital. And it's sort of, so how do I think about that now? What I think we've learned, sort of like a little bit of what John was saying, is that, yes, the environment matters
mm-hmm.
In terms of how people do. And, you know, actually what I've heard now very interestingly from many of the peer movement is that stress itself, you know, stress is complicated because what's stressful for one person is not for another, and we have a tendency not to have expectations, and for some people, not having expectations is stressful. At any rate, I think the lesson learned now is that we have ways to work effectively with families, with people in individual support systems, meeting their needs, providing them psychoeducation and
right.
outlets, and that's really where it's at. I mean, expressed emotion is just one way of classifying family members and individuals. Interactions that I'm not sure is particularly useful anymore.
Good, thank you. Here's a terrific question. We still have a few more minutes for questions from one of our early champions of first episode and other short-term intensive community-based services, Dr. Ilana Nossel at PI. Can you speak to the role of inpatient treatment for individuals with FEP, and specifically whether inpatient units should consider a different psychopharmacological approach? I think she's referring more to acute care units than our more intermediate units. Different pharmacological approaches to FEP patients than for other psychotic disorders. For example, how does the guidance start low and go slow apply to inpatient treatment, if at all? And how do you do that in this environment of managed care where, there's such a drive for demand for symptom reduction in days?
Well, on the positive side, patients with first episode schizophrenia generally respond well to medication, and response can occur fairly quickly. At the same time, we believe that those patients require, special attention, if you will, and that the staff working with those patients should be trained. Because the concern that many of us have is that when we are accustomed to working with very chronic patients, we lose sight of some of the special challenges associated with treating the very first episode, which has, I think, unique challenges. Lower doses can be very effective. People are very sensitive to side effects, et cetera, et cetera.
So we can achieve as much with less.
Yes.
Yes.
But sometimes inpatient treatment is necessary.
Yes.
Ideally, we'd like to have a unit that's dedicated to early phase patients or at least young people to meet their special needs. That's what we've tried to do at Zucker Hillside. But, we know that many institutions don't see a lot of first episode patients, so we have to think about, how to structure care wherever someone might be receiving it.
Right. Let me have one more question before we turn to some of your material, John. And this comes from Dr. Ann Fernandez, a close colleague here in Albany and medical director of behavioral health at CDPHP, Doctors Plan here in Albany. Terrific colleague. And she asks, can you comment on a question I love, on using long-acting antipsychotics earlier in the course of illness and whether or not one's prognosis can be improved by doing so? She also mentions clozapine, but let's confine it for the moment to depot or long-acting antipsychotics. John, do you?
Well,
is that going to be part of your comments as well?
Not really, okay. Because I think that the opportunity to consider long-acting injectable antipsychotics is very important. I think a lot of physicians have been hesitant to mention that as an alternative, particularly during the early phase of illness. But there are studies, particularly Keith Nuchterlein's work at UCLA, suggesting that long-acting injectable medications might actually have even more of an impact in the early phase of illness.
Beneficial
impact. So this still needs a lot more work, but I think the notion that we can provide, stability of access to medication during the early phase of illness is very important. But Lisa and I are going to be talking a little bit later about the possibility of reducing dosage or even discontinuing medication. So a balance has to be struck. But I think for certain patients, it is an important opportunity.
And if I could just add to that, all of this, any of these decisions need to be made collaboratively with the person who's being affected. Mm-hmm. And there may be people who want to take long-acting injectable. Mm-hmm. And in that case, they should absolutely... Yeah. It should absolutely be available.
We shouldn't conclude that just because it's an injection, someone doesn't want it.
Exactly. Yeah. And people have the right to know all of their options.
Right. Good. Okay. There are other questions, but I want to segue and make sure we have a good time to learn from Dr. Kane. So, John, do you want to pick up on the slide presentation?
Sure. Thanks very much. So we've alluded to some of these points. When we talk about pharmacologic treatment of first episode schizophrenia, we need to remind ourselves that the response rate is often quite high. So 70 to 80% of patients might have a pretty good response and actually achieve remission of symptoms within a matter of weeks. But lower doses are needed. And this requires constant reminding because we still, as we'll show you in a few minutes, we still see patients around the country being treated with higher than necessary doses at the first episode. Rates of side effects are high even when we use low doses, because people getting medicine for the first time are very sensitive to the side effects. And particularly if you're in a situation where you're very ambivalent about taking medicine, then those side effects can have tremendous impact. The other thing to remind ourselves is that no single medication, including clozapine, has demonstrated better efficacy in terms of symptom response for the treatment of the initial episode. So we tend to focus on the relative tolerability of medications. We're more likely to choose a medicine that's going to have lower rates of side effects. But again, we'd like to engage the patient in a discussion of, you know, if this drug might cause side effect A and this drug might cause side effect B, which one would you prefer?
Yeah, yeah.
We also have concluded that olanzapine, which, you know, is a very effective drug, is a second-line treatment due to the weight gain. And we've also seen that patients during the early phase of illness are particularly vulnerable to the metabolic side effects, so their young age doesn't protect them from that.
Research at your facility has shown in 12 weeks that in adolescence they start to show metabolic changes.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so we have to be very concerned about that. As Lisa mentioned, we were fortunate to receive funding from NIMH as part of this RAISE initiative, and ours is called the Early Treatment Program. And what it entails is we're working with 34 community clinics in 21 states across the United States. We wanted to demonstrate that this could be implemented in community clinics, not necessarily research sites. And patients are randomly assigned to either receive the enhanced multimodal intervention. Lisa talked about the critical ingredients in that intervention. So they're randomized to either that or to receive community care, which mm-hmm. is to receive the care that they would ordinarily get in those clinics. So we have 404 patients participating in the study. And what we've done, on what we have on this slide, is just some data from looking at the baseline medications that patients were receiving. We did not identify these patients at their very first medication treatment. So they were eligible to participate in our study if they had less than 6 months of exposure to medication. So what we've seen is that about 39% of these individuals might have benefited from changes in their psychotropic medication based on existing guidelines. For example, many patients, 32%, were given olanzapine, which we do not think is a first-line medication for first-episode patients, often at higher doses than are recommended by the guidelines for first-episode patients, which is 15 milligrams. In addition, we saw that 23% were prescribed more than one antipsychotic, which we would not expect to see in first-episode patients. And then 36% were prescribed antidepressants without a clear indication. Now, we certainly believe that antidepressants may very well be indicated in some patients with schizophrenia, and they often can be very helpful. But we'd like to see in the medical record the reason why. And what we found is that the prescription of antidepressant was not consistent with what we saw in the structured diagnostic interview. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe people were prescribing it for negative symptoms with the hope that it would help there, but again, we didn't see the documentation to support that. So this just points out that when you look at the treatment that's being given in real-world clinics around the country, we still haven't caught up with the guidelines.
Yeah, it's true in so many treatments in terms of the gap between what we know and what we do.
Absolutely. And then the challenge of adherence. So we know that there are high rates of non-adherence and that those rates of non-adherence, as we saw on an earlier slide, are associated with psychotic relapse. Clinicians must understand the various factors that can contribute to non-adherence, side effects, real or perceived lack of efficacy, and this is part of the psychoeducation and shared decision-making process. People need to understand what these drugs can and can't do. The drugs can be very helpful for certain types of symptoms, but not so helpful for others. Patients need to understand that. Patients may want to try without medicine. And again, this gets back to the shared decision making. You know, what do they know about the risks? What do they know about the potential benefits? And what do we know? Because we still have many unanswered questions. The excessive complexity of the regimen. So when we see, for example, patients receiving more than one antipsychotic mm-hmm. drug, why is that if they're receiving concomitant antidepressants without a clear indication? Why is that? The more medicines that someone has to take, the more likely they are to miss some doses.
Yeah, and this is, I can't help but editorialize a little bit here because we've been concerned about that. There's an inverse relationship between the number of medications somebody has prescribed and the frequency during the day, multiple administrations, and they're following instructions. And the AIDS treatment world learned this a long time ago. If you give one pill per day, people are apt to take it. If you give 20 pills three times during the course of a day, barely anybody can follow a regimen like that. So we're often, there's often a fiction that we think that adding more and doing more is actually going to translate into somebody getting more. And that's not necessarily the case.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So excuse my editorial.
No, thank you. That's very important. So just continuing in terms of non-adherence and the importance of shared decision-making. So, you know, some of the factors that have been cited as playing a critical role in facilitating adherence are the nature of the therapeutic alliance, and that obviously involves shared decision-making, engaging family and supports. So that means someone has the relatives, their loved ones, their significant others need to understand, you know, what are the indications and rationale for medication, because they're going to play a role as well, psychoeducation. And then I emphasize the assessment of side effects. So sometimes physicians are not thorough in asking about all side effects, and patients may not come forward with sexual dysfunction, for example. So we need to ask about that. Exercises such as psychiatric medication in me or finding personal motivation to use medication, kinds of things that Pat Deegan has been talking about. And the important thing to emphasize here is that medication is not an end in and of itself. Medication is something that can facilitate the achievement of a goal. Mm-hmm. And that's, we need to keep that in mind when we're just talking to our patients. And then developing an inventory of early signs of relapse, because we believe that if we can identify a relapse quickly, we're in a better position to do something about it. So the study that you referred to earlier, and I think it's important in terms of helping us to keep a balanced view, was recently published by Wunderlich et al. In JAMA Psychiatry. And this was based or started with a study that was done several years ago, focusing on whether or not some patients with first episode schizophrenia could undergo substantial reduction in dosage and still do well. And the initial study, and here we see the participant flow. So of the 257 eligible patients, we can see that about half of them participated in the study. And what the study showed was that when attempts were made to reduce dosage, there was an increase in relapse rates. But some patients were able to undergo successful dosage reduction. And the follow-up study that was done with 7 years of follow-up and involving a little bit over 100 patients actually showed that the patients who underwent the dosage reduction were more likely to experience recovery than the patients who continued on the maintenance treatment arm. Now, this is complicated. There are a number of different elements that need to be considered here, and there's no one study that can definitively answer this question. But it does raise the possibility that there is a subgroup of patients who may be able to tolerate substantial dosage reduction or even dosage discontinuation and have a better chance of recovery than if they were to continue on medication in an uninterrupted fashion. The challenge here, and obviously we want to give Lisa a chance to talk about this. The challenge here is, you know, how do we identify the subgroup to whom that would apply? And what are the risks associated with the steps that we have to go through to identify that subgroup? Someday, hopefully, we'll have better biomarkers or better algorithms to help identify those people. Right now, it's a delicate balance. But again, it gets back to having the information to share with the patient and then letting them use their judgment as to what risks, what benefits they want to entertain.
Lisa?
Sure. Yeah, this is a really, really interesting and important study. And I wanted to just underscore a couple of things that we need to incorporate in our care of these individuals. As John said, individuals were randomized to either maintenance treatment or to a dosage reduction. And it doesn't mean, you know, as it turns, it doesn't mean that people were randomly assigned to go off meds. It just means that that was the sort of the doctor's and the instructions. And what they found was that after 18 months, the rates of relapse were higher in the individuals who were randomized to the dosage reduction arm. There was not a single advantage to dosage reduction after 18 months. It was not as good functional recovery and outcome, and there was more relapses. That's bad. So the early paper that presented these early findings were, wow, we got to be really careful about dosage reduction. 7 years later.
7 years after the 18 months?
I think it was a total of seven years.
Mm-hmm.
Lo and behold, more of the individuals who were in the dosage reduction were actually recovered. Right? So you had a short-term sort of adverse outcome and a longer-term benefit. So how do we, and again, I think this is really the, you know, we're very, very focused on reducing relapse, and we should be, because relapse can be scary, dangerous, problematic, can be a setback, maybe toxic to the brain, all these things. But then how do we understand the fact that 7 years later, of this subgroup that was followed, and, you know, it's not the whole sample, and there are things that we have to kind of worry about, but 7 years later, you know, double the rates of recovery. So it really suggests that, you know, there's a lot we don't know, that maybe antipsychotics and maybe relapse, you know, isn't as bad for everyone. And we have to work collaboratively with individuals to help them, you know, kind of navigate both this new information and also to really get more research on, well, who for whom, both in terms of, you know, their response, but also their sort of biological response, but also their psychosocial and emotional response. You know, maybe for some people the relapse is, it's not, you know, they can manage it, they have support. But for other people, it's you know, might really set them into a very, very bad spiral. So we had this is all about both, I think, getting more information on who can who for whom is this relevant in terms of their illness.
Has there been discussion as a consequence about phase-based treatment? So you're emphasizing the you know, which group may. This may pertain to, but is there some implication here that the goals for 18 months are different, and that maybe conversations are let's try to keep you well for 18 months and then make a change as a different phase or something that happens there? Has that been part of the conversation?
That's certainly one of the potential implications. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you know, how do we demarcate these different phases? Mm-hmm. Because it's not going to be a calendar; it's going to be an individual.
Right. Right.
And,
But this study, it's very interesting that it was the original treatment assignment determined the ultimate outcome. So
So
I should say, in understanding this study, it's not as if the people in the dosage reduction arm did not get medication. Mm-hmm. Most people in both arms got medication.
Right.
As it turns out, the people in the dosage reduction arm had a somewhat lower dose.
Mm-hmm.
And there were people in both arms, actually, who didn't have medication and did okay. But it may well be that the decisions we make early on may have a longer-term impact. Mm-hmm. And that's why we need to really get a better understanding of how that works.
It's a terrific discussion. I want to make sure we get through there. John, you've got one more slide to take us through. My apologies. So let me open the phone lines. We also have some other questions that have come in. You can call us at 877-280-7400. If you do call, please go to another room or turn down the speaker in the room so that we don't get that horrific feedback experience. You've heard the number. You can fax us, 518-426-4098, or again, email swgr@omh.ny.gov. So please give us a call or send us some more emails. I'm going to go back to some that have come in. Here is one that asks, would you comment on strategies for engaging working with young people whose life circumstances are such that they are not on track, quote unquote, and consequently have little experience identifying or achieving goals? Mm-hmm. Lisa, you want to start with that?
Yeah, sure. I think what the question is asking is how, when you've got individuals who may develop psychosis, mm-hmm. who already have a host of problems and may be dealing with, not being with peers mm-hmm. The way that we would expect. And I think that that's a challenge that we deal with when we're working with any person, with any of these young people with psychiatric issues, and also the social service system deals with them, and we have many tools. But I think it's always about going to where that individual is, trying to help them to be hopeful, to develop goals that are consistent with their world, their culture, and. It's going to be that much harder in people who haven't had successes to build on.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean they can't be successful.
That they may not know what they want in life.
Yeah.
Also, we were having a conversation earlier. You were talking about those people who are using a lot of marijuana or alcohol, and whose goal may be, I want to continue to get high.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you field something like that?
It's so I want to get a job because I want more money to get high.
Right. And that again. I'm not sure everybody heard that.
I said, how do you deal with the situation of I want to get a job because I want more money to buy more drugs? And I think that you're working in multiple fronts mm-hmm. in multiple ways, and you can't. I mean, the bottom line is you can't say, well. Okay, that's not a good reason to work, therefore we're not going to help you to work.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the response
mm-hmm.
to that is, that's not the proper response. It's, okay, well, let's how can we get you to work? And then at the same time, you're collaborating with that person to help them understand, perhaps, that the substances may not allow them to keep their job or may cause them other problems.
Right.
But you just can't negate what people mm-hmm. want.
Yeah.
It just doesn't work.
Yeah. John?
No, I agree completely, and this comes up even when we're talking about substance abuse in the treatment. I mean, there have been patients who smoke marijuana, and I think their clinicians sometimes have made a mistake saying, well, if you continue to do that, I'm not going to treat you anymore.
Yeah.
That we have to understand, this is that human behavior is complex. There are many factors that drive our motivation, our goals, and we have to be very thoughtful and very patient-centered in how we, mm-hmm. How we work on these things.
Yeah.
And I think that engagement, we haven't really spoken that much of how hard it is to engage these young people
mm-hmm.
because they do not want an illness. They often do not understand. They don't label what has happened to them as an illness. The last thing anybody wants to do is go to a go to a hospital or go to a clinic, and it really interferes with their life.
Yes.
So,
sure
so in the end, I think what often we come down to in our discussions and working with patients and families is let's just do everything to find a common ground. In mm-hmm. Pat Deegan's words, do everything to get them to come back. That maybe they don't see it this way today, but they may see it differently tomorrow. And if we can keep at it, if we can keep the dialogue going, then there's always this hopefulness.
Yeah. Just going back to the use of alcohol or pot or other drugs, what I guess we've got to also understand is that people do things for a reason, I'm not talking necessarily about self-medication, but there are there's a gain for them in using these substances. They may be more socially at ease. They may be able to get out of the house. Some of them are just racked to the ceiling with anxiety, with fears, and that it actually diminishes that, lets them function. These are really important needs that they're serving through the substances that we have to ask about and appreciate it. Otherwise, we are nowhere in terms of our patients.
Absolutely. And, you know, here we are in the midst of a time when, you know, marijuana is becoming legal in some areas and being used medically. And if I'm a patient, I'm asking, well, what's different about me? And but yet there may be something different about me. I may have a brain that, you know, is very vulnerable to certain kinds of environmental stressors. And, you know, marijuana or excessive marijuana or alcohol may be one of those stressors. So, you know, we have to strike that balance.
Right. And that's where that risk-benefit conversation comes in without using those words. There's another question that came in from a colleague now at PI, used to be at Rockland, Dr. Andrew Kirsch. And ask this question to both of you, I think. The group, this goes back to the Wunderlich study. So did I get the name right?
Wunderlich.
Wunderlich. Thank you. The group in the dose reduction arm, did the study drill down on the dosing after the initial 18 months of reduction? Did dose continue to reduce during the 7 years? I think, did the dose possibly go up for some people in the dose reduction after the initial phase? I think he's trying to parse out a little bit whether there's more information here that might inform practice.
You want to take that? So my read of the study, it's complicated, and there is quite a bit of information in the paper about the antipsychotic dosing patterns. And I think, to me, the take-home message is that there definitely, you know, there were individual patterns, but on the whole, the individuals in the maintenance treatment arm had somewhat more medicine, somewhat more antipsychotics and higher doses, whereas individuals in the dosage reduction arm had somewhat lower. But they both arms, you know, most people in both arms had antipsychotic medications even after the 18 months. What was interesting
and
that
variability,
the
ups and downs as well.
The investigators noted that the initial treatment assignment did seem to influence the pattern of receipt of antipsychotics even after the study was over. And they speculated, well, they wondered why that is. You know, is that because people, the people in the taper arm just were more inclined to ask for lower doses or to receive lower doses? So even after the study was over, there were some persistent differences. But I wouldn't want people to think that individuals in either arm were all like med free.
Right. John?
No, I agree. And actually, there's some work by Marty Harrow, who followed a cohort in Chicago, where after a long term follow up, he made some similar suggestions that there may be some patients who actually do better, better off medications.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Good. Here's another question, one of several, but I want to pull one out that comes from Dr. Mary Barber, our clinical director at Rockland Psychiatric Center, that begins to ask, what should we be teaching our trainees? What should we be teaching residents, fellows, even medical students regarding what are the messages that we give to people who have mental illness, particularly psychotic mental illness, because those people are going to turn up not just in psychiatric practice, specialty practices, but for medical students, when those who are in more general practice and other settings. What is it that we should be trying to convey and embody in the way, in the behavior, the clinical behavior of trainees?
Well, there are so many things, it's hard to know where to begin. But I think one of the first steps is that our colleagues need to understand that these are illnesses like any other illness, and that they should not be viewed as in a separate category. These are medical illnesses, well validated. I know there's been criticism of our nosology, of our diagnostic system, but actually, I think the diagnosis of schizophrenia is highly valid and highly reliable, even though it may ultimately represent more than a single disorder. But right now, I think we should not be embarrassed about our ability to make diagnoses that have implications for treatment, for outcome, for genetics, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's a key message. I think the other key message is the tremendous variability and heterogeneity and the importance of, you know, focusing on the individual, as we've emphasized, shared decision-making, setting personal goals, and keeping an open mind, but also keeping abreast of the data. We discussed a few minutes ago how difficult it is to get guidelines implemented and data implemented. So I think we have to really encourage our trainees to be to be evidence-based whenever possible, to keep an open mind, and undoubtedly some of what we're doing now is wrong,
yeah.
and that we have to try to recognize that as quickly as possible.
Yeah. Lisa, quickly, because
sure.
I want to get to another question.
I think that what I would say is that this, and I'm thinking more about psychiatric residents now for the moment as opposed to in medical school students. I think that one of the lessons that we've learned from this work is that we should not, and I'll go out on a limb here, maybe be a little provocative, mm-hmm. we should not be telling people you need medication for your whole life.
Yeah.
I don't think we should say that, and I think we teach people to say it, mm-hmm. and it's part of what we have thought in the past of as psychoeducation.
Now, Mary mentions that, the analogy to diabetes.
Yeah.
But we even know people with diabetes, they lose some weight or they even have bariatric surgery and then they're off of their meds.
Right. And I would say, why do we have to say that?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
We don't know,
mm-hmm.
and it doesn't serve any purpose.
Mm-hmm.
We may be wrong, and it's also extremely, it really takes away any sort of hope. I mean, if for someone being off meds is important, then, I think we have to change our language.
We should stop talking that way.
I think so.
Good. Now, let me ask a question. This is a really important question. Comes from Binghamton, Dr. Ramona Mazzeo. I work as a psychiatrist in a college health and counseling service and have seen several first break episodes in intelligent, previously high-functioning students. Due to the students' right to return to school almost immediately, as long as they're not dangerous, many will resume college coursework weeks or even days following an acute hospitalization. Is there data that helps us understand the ability to return to full functioning, like this schoolwork so quickly? She goes on, even saying when medications are effective, that these are complex decisions. Is it better if they push through or if they allow some time for recovery? Lisa, you want to?
Again, I'm going to answer that question by saying it depends.
Mm-hmm.
And it depends on the person, it depends on the situation, and it depends on the school, it depends on their supports. And I'm not aware of any data where you could say 100% of the time a person should do this or that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the most important thing is that individual be provided with services that can help them to make a decision.
Mm-hmm.
For some people, the stress of not returning to school is greater than the stress of returning to school.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that being said, I think it's probably fair to say that, I mean, if I, you know, if you sustain an injury of any kind,
mm-hmm.
It may be wiser to cut back a little bit.
Right.
If I were to be talking with someone about mm-hmm. this, that's part of how I would be discussing.
Right. So if you're playing for the soccer team
mm-hmm.
And you twist your ankle, mm-hmm. you don't mm-hmm. want to go out and play a full game the next day. Right?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
But I think where we get into trouble, frankly, is by making statements that we believe are 100% true for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And I, at least in my experience, when you have the dialogue, supported dialogue, and you have a relationship, you have the supported dialogue, you have the family there,
mm-hmm.
then people will often make decisions that everyone, agrees with. Now, that doesn't happen all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And again, what Pat Deegan talks a lot about is the dignity of risk. And the dignity, what that refers to is the right in some way for people to make mistakes, to take chances, and then to learn from them. And so we can't take that away. Now, again, it's all risky.
Right.
But
say that again, the dignity.
The dignity of risk.
Right. John, do you want to have a word here before we get to the close?
I agree with what Lisa said, but I think also when we're thinking about returning to school, and Lisa said, not returning to school quickly can also be very disturbing. But That too depends on, well, what are the alternatives?
Mm-hmm.
Can I find something meaningful for that person to do while they're waiting to, recover a little bit more? Because that's a key ingredient.
Right.
Yeah.
And what you want to try to do is to help. I mean, adapting to any illness or any life circumstance means sometimes creating new options, mm-hmm. new paths.
Yeah. Right.
And that's part of what we do in working with people that, you think, well, there's only one way to succeed in life. Well, that's not true.
Right.
There's many ways to
right.
succeed in life.
Yeah. And for young people, now, I gather, having five or six careers in their 20s is now modal, as opposed to at least when I started, where that was seen as, you know, there must be something the matter with that guy.
And just not knowing what they want to do.
right. And in fact, having so many options for some young people.
And it's the, you know, the one door closes, another opens. And what you want to be able to do is to make sure that those doors can open and that a person doesn't think that all doors are closed.
Good. Thank you. Let's leave it on that nice note. So in conclusion, let me offer our following take-home messages for clinicians from today's Ground Rounds. Engaging individuals experiencing a first episode of psychosis into treatment as early as possible can alter the course of a person's life by maintaining functioning and optimizing recovery. Second, individuals experiencing FEP benefit most from a team-based care that includes outreach, family education and support, attention to work and school, and therapy and medications. And third, psychopharmacological treatment of individuals experiencing first episode psychosis should use low doses of medication and shared decision-making with consumers and families to enhance adherence, because when people stay in treatment, they're much more likely to benefit from it. So to Lisa and to John, my great thanks to both of you for your participation, for teaching us so much about such an important topic. We value your opinion, so please take a moment to complete a brief evaluation for this Grand Rounds. There are only five multiple-choice questions and one write-in question, so you can offer us your thoughts. And we use that information to build on our programming and the topics, as well as the content of each individual topic. So please give us your thoughts. Thank you for watching. We're going to also hope that you'll join us again on January 15th for our next statewide Grand Rounds, where our guest will be OMH Acting Commissioner. She may be actually appointed by the Senate at that point, but our new commissioner, Dr. Anne Marie Sullivan. I look forward to speaking with her and hearing her thoughts about her experience that she's had in a career as a public health psychiatrist and administrator, and what she brings here into her new role as our new OMH commissioner. So until then, thank you for watching. Be well, and a good holiday season to all of you.